This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host on the channel. And today I'm thrilled to talk with Sam Moyne about his terrific new book, Humane: How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Sam is the Henry R. Luce Professor of Jurisprudence at Yale University, and he's the author of several previous books. As I read this book, I remembered a Star Trek episode that I watched when I was a kid. And looking back on it, the title is A Taste of Armageddon. And in this Star Trek episode, our intrepid heroes of Star Trek, Kirk and Spock and so on, find a planet which had been engaged in a long-running conflict that had cost it thousands or hundreds of thousands or perhaps millions of lives. I don't remember exactly how many. But it was a conflict fought virtually. The computers would decide who had died. And those people would report to a station where they would be killed. And as Kirk and Spock ask about this, the explanation they get is that real war is too hard and too painful and too costly. And so they have evolved or created a system which minimizes the cost of war. But in order to do this, casts millions or hundreds of thousands of people to be killed as a result of virtual decisions. Kirk, as is his wont, destroys the computers, and the people they had who had been conducting this war are in despair because they believe that war is inevitable and nothing can prevent it. And the best possible answer to this is to minimize its cost. And Kirk, in his usual rational Enlightenment fashion, goes ahead to claim that war is in fact a human creation and can be harnessed or eliminated, as they would have known if they had not limited the cost. And that episode struck me and came back to mind as I read Sam's book, which is indeed a book about this question of the seemingly paradoxical challenge. Can making war more humane actually make it more common? And has that been what has happened in the recent past? It's a great book, and I learned a lot about it, and I'm teaching comparative genocide this semester, and I've spent the last week or so regaling my students with stories that I heard in it. And so I'm looking forward to talking to Sam about this book and exploring this issue. So Sam, thanks for joining us, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Sam, we always start the same way, which is to ask you to say a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in this question.
Well, I'm an American. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I grew up there and went to college there and became a historian and a law professor And in my youth, which was the 1990s, I got excited about the prospects that American force could make the world a better place. And I worked in the White House for a bit as a law student on the Kosovo bombings. And it was really kind of living through the years after 9/11 that I saw my country, which had already kind of gone to war supposedly for good causes, go to a lot more wars, and wars that made not just the world, but this country worse off. And I decided to write the book when I noticed that Barack Obama, who so many people voted for because he might end some wars, actually said in speeches that he had to continue American war, but was making it kinder and gentler, more humane, and maybe in a sense moral. And I wanted to understand how could this be possible, and, you know, get at the debates that even before Captain Kirk, you know, folks have been having around the world about whether to try to constrain war from happening or to make it humane when it comes.
So how does this, you've published several previous books, how does this book fit into the previous work you've done? Is it a continuation of other ideas you've been exploring, or is it a departure?
A little of both. You know, I've written some books on ethics, and I've written some books on human rights politics, and probably my best known book from about 10 years ago called The Last Utopia is about how human rights became well known in the 1970s. And I definitely am following that book in arguing that the laws of war, which are very old, you know, biblical, at least in the Western tradition, were made more humane in the 1970s in the requirements they placed on states and militaries. But in other ways, it's a departure because I think I'm more suspicious of the laws of war than I was in writing about human rights, because my worry is that if we get so concerned with making war humane under these new laws, we may end up perpetuating an evil we could end. And I don't think human rights are, you know, I'm not suspicious of human rights in that same way. So it's different, but it's definitely about the same period, you know, my lifetime, because I think in both cases, something new is happening in international politics, and it has to do with kind of ethical claims that come to be, you know, credible to people in an arena in which so many people once thought it was just about power and violence.
Mm-hmm. And for listeners, Sam did an interview on the book you mentioned, a podcast interview several years ago, and I encourage you to go back and listen to it. So why start the book with Tolstoy?
So I start with Leo Tolstoy for a few reasons. One, you know, the primary reason is that it just so happens that he was present at the creation of the idea that we could use international law to make war more humane. In the 1860s, while Tolstoy was writing War and Peace, some Swiss gentlemen called European states together and got them to agree to let them take care of wounded soldiers on battlefields. And that became the Red Cross. And the rules they wrote, the first Geneva Convention, are the kind of wellspring of all the laws of war later, including the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which were talked a lot about during the War on Terror. But Tolstoy wasn't just present. He noticed this project and said it was bad. And so, you know, it's the kind of thing that surprises you, because how could anyone think it's bad to make war less brutal? And I don't, but I try to show that as he grew old and became a pacifist and vegetarian, Tolstoy began to think that there were some risks that making war humane could court. And I think the truth is that he was a prophet before his time, because those risks only became real in our lifetimes, when war actually did become more humane and the law governing it was actually transformed and taken seriously for the first time. And so it turns out that Tolstoy was kind of prescient. And I wanted to kind of show how prescient he was and how long it took then for the syndrome he worried about to come online.
Yeah, I was really, I was intrigued. You compared this to the debate about slavery and the dangers some people saw about making slavery more humane. Can you just kind of, it's a little bit of a sideline, but can you unpack that a little bit and talk about how these two are similar?
Absolutely. So, you know, actually, it's Tolstoy's analogy, and he also compared the project of making war humane to the project of making the slaughter of non-human animals humane. And he's, what he's trying to do is identify the way these risks that he sensed could play out. So in the slavery analogy, he's living at the time of the abolition of serfdom in his own Russian Empire and the abolition of slavery in this country through the U.S. Civil War. And he says, you know, remember that in the early 19th century, there was no abolitionist movement, or not a big one. And most reformers were trying to create humane slavery. And they made a deal with slave owners. They didn't contest their right to own other people. So these slaveholders, you know, got to keep their slaves, but reformers who demanded humane slavery asked for them to treat those slaves less cruelly. And Tolstoy thinks back and says this was a bad compromise because it kind of conceded the real evil and then tried to kind of blunt its effects. And he said, what if we're making the same mistake with war? Now, of course, war could be different. Maybe we can't abolish it, or we can't gather forces to abolish it or keep one war from happening that's unjust. And then it makes sense to do what, you know, the reformers who created humane slavery did. But maybe the analogy holds. Maybe, like, we could have, if not no war, then fewer wars, and we should focus on that rather than kind of making deals with the military, taking whether they can fight and whether states can fight off the table, and just begging them to do it more humanely.
And your book show how there is some effort to make war humane, but there are really significant limitations to the agreements and treaties that are created. So what are some of the ways they tried to limit, or thinkers and actors and politicians and advocates tried to limit war in the 19th and early 20th century? And what were some of the limitations that continued?
So Tolstoy's suggestion that was a pacifist one, and he thought the remedy was for soldiers to, you know, refuse to serve. But I try to follow how others invented the anti-war movement or peace movement and tried to figure out how they could get states to agree not to fight, to settle their differences, and so forth. Meanwhile, there was a crew, the Red Cross and their followers, who were trying to kind of follow up on that first Geneva Convention for the sake of wounded soldiers and do things like ban weapons or restrict kind of hospitals from being targeted, above all to protect POWs when they're captured. And mostly these don't really work in making war more humane for kind of three reasons. The first is really that most of the laws of war actually allow the military to do more stuff and to claim necessity to override any other constraints. Then there's the fact that like these rules didn't apply to certain kinds of warfare, especially colonial warfare against non-whites. And then finally, even when they did apply, like in World War One, they were just dropped when push comes to shove. And so that's why Tolstoy was, in a sense, too early, because you could only run the risk of perpetuating war by making it humane if you actually do it. And for more than a century, it just didn't happen. Now, after World War II, the Geneva Conventions were forged. But the reason I claim that the 1970s were so important is that after decolonization, the victims of all those colonial wars in the new states of the world pushed for genuinely humane rules of war. And Europeans who were no longer fighting those colonial wars, having lost their empires, were in position to agree. Finally, Americans had lost the Vietnam War and gotten shamed in the international community over My Lai, this terrible atrocity that was revealed in 1969. And so the moment was right to actually kind of do what had never been done. And I point to two big innovations. One is that finally states agree that they can't target civilians. And as I narrate, they've been doing that for decades with the rise of aerial bombardment, but they agree to stop. And then they agree to limit collateral damage. So they say, well, okay, we'll only aim at military targets. We'll also agree that if too many civilians will die, even when we strike a military target, we won't proceed. That's known as the rule of proportionality. And both of these rules became central to war, great power war, ever since. And I try to show how not just humanitarians like Human Rights Watch, but big forces in the military itself respond by trying to take the newly humane rules of war seriously. And the result was to transform war in our time.
Let's come back to that in just a second. And go backwards briefly. Because, of course, Wilson talked about World War I as a war to end all wars. And there is some effort in the 20s and 30s to bring that into place. So probably most people know the story of the League of Nations, but there's other kind of ways that people try and prevent war, forestall war. So can you say a little bit about how they try and create this pacifist vision and why it doesn't work? And then maybe, you don't talk about this at least as I read the book, but maybe speculate a little about some of the ways they pick up on this effort to prevent war in the aftermath of both the U.S. and the Soviet Union getting nuclear weapons. How does that tradition of being afraid of war fit with this earlier attempt to end war as a phenomenon?
Great. So I mentioned that after Tolstoy, lots of new activists really focus on peace and struggle to bring it at least to the transatlantic zone of the kind of America and the European empires. And they propose things like an arbitration arrangement. They proposed the League of Nations after World War I, which Wilson, of course, had hoped at least for white states across the Atlantic would settle, you know, belligerency for good. The trouble is America isn't willing to join the League of Nations and serve as a guarantor of that European peace. You know, there are other things like, you know, there are disarmament conferences in the middle of the years between the two world wars, in hopes of, you know, making the kind of stakes of war when it comes just less. But of course, World War II did come, and it's in this circumstance, I try to show that America does engage with the European peace, and if you like, guarantees it, but it's at a high price because America also signs up to fight wars around the world of the sort Europeans have been fighting for centuries. Now, the United States, you know, even before it was a country, involved lots of native violence that was brutal on both sides. And we conquered the Philippines and engaged in a pretty brutal counterinsurgency there at the turn of the 20th century. But after World War II, there's endless intervention and war is really brutal. So I try to show that the war in the Pacific at the end of World War II and Korea and Vietnam are, you know, it are about America's global wars before humanity comes. But, you know, it's through those same processes that European peace is secured and America becomes less a force for peace than freedom. I mean, the Soviet Union claims to be a peace power. It takes over Eastern Europe, but compared to the United States, it's not in doing big military intervention globally. And America is a kind of missionary power, kind of tolerating lots of global violence for the sake of anti-communist freedom. And so it becomes very hard after World War II for ordinary Americans to mobilize for peace. It seems like the other side's agenda and a mask for their totalitarianism. So, you know, this is the situation when the Vietnam War comes, which does create, you know, the biggest peace movement since the interwar years in the United States. And what I try to show is that the terms of debate over Vietnam after 1965, when the United States escalates troops there, is really around whether the war should be fought principally. And when My Lai is revealed in the first instance and people get concerned about atrocity, it's for the sake of ending that war. Because, you know, if you've lived through, you know, World War II, you think that if war breaks out, it's going to be brutal. And, you know, our ancestors had the idea that keeping war from happening will keep war crimes from happening, while the reverse isn't true. And so that's why I see Vietnam as both bringing about our era of humane war, but also a kind of counterpoint to the way we think about war. We so often kind of isolate war crimes, including genocide, of course, for our moral opprobrium, you know, and don't focus as much on the fact that these happen most often during wars.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I wonder, I've been doing some work on Algeria lately, French Algeria, and of course there's huge amounts of debates and debate and argument in France about the way in which this war is conducted, and the particular kinds of interrogations that go on, not simultaneously, but close in time. There are massacres in Indonesia. How do those more, and British oppression in Kenya, how do those more global manifestations of imperial wars, I guess that's a reasonable term, we'll use that term for now without question, how does that play into this debate?
So what you could say is that Europeans are in advance of the United States because they're in a distinctive position after World War II. They fight, you know, their own counterinsurgencies brutally. They lose as America does in Vietnam, but the result is that they're out of the business of formal empire. And so in the 70s, they've had these big debates over torture in Algeria and over, you know, concentration camps in the, you know, Kenyan emergency. I mean, actually, it's only much later that we know how bad it really was. But the in a sense, they can try to wash their hands of imperial violence in the 1970s and since. And they're also part of the emerging European human rights regime. The United States is off on its own. It's fought Korea brutally, but there hasn't been a big outcry. It fights Vietnam brutally. And that's when the outcry comes. And by this point, Europeans are kind of attempting to rehabilitate themselves, and they join with the new post-colonial states to push for humane war. And so America is just, let's say, 10 years behind, you know, and it is, and yet the difference is that after the 70s, it's still going to fight a lot of global wars. And so my thesis is that where Europeans certainly assisted with a lot of American wars in the Cold War and since, it's the United States that's kind of leading the charge, building the coalitions, doing the dirty work. And therefore, it's kind of the scene of this humanization process, because it's actually still fighting, unlike European empires, which have shut down beforehand.
And we've been kind of talking about that significant development that happens, the change in the discussion and the discourse in the 70s. I wonder if you could say a little bit about two other parts of that that you identify in your book. One is the elevation of the Holocaust in European and American memory. And the other is the growth of human rights institutions like Human Rights Watch. What did those play in this pivot that happens in the 70s?
Well, you're getting at some absolutely pivotal features, I think, of the story, and, you know, one of unintended consequences. So after World War II, of course, there's a genocide convention. There are Nuremberg trials, but often it's thought to be a Holocaust trial, whereas in fact it was principally an aggression trial. In the spirit of that commitment I mentioned after World War II, which has a lot of roots, that the priority is constraining the outbreak of war. And so Adolf Hitler's henchmen are tried at Nuremberg for starting the war. And of course, there is attention to war crimes and crimes against humanity, but it's not given as much attention. And actually, the Holocaust is very little dealt with at the International Military Tribunal. If you like, the world wasn't ready to center Jewish death in their understanding of what had gone wrong in World War II. In a later generation, people are ready. And I think Americans in particular lived through a big change where they have not seen much moral problem in the civilian harm they've perpetrated you know, in the end of World War II over the Japanese islands or in Korea. In Vietnam, there's the beginning of a moral transformation, and it goes along with the memory of World War II, which is changing to feature Jewish death. And, you know, people begin to learn in school and in from, you know, media that what goes wrong in war is civilian harm. And that's the evil to oppose. Meanwhile, as anti-war movements of the Vietnam era are cratering, there are new humanitarian movements like the rise of Human Rights Watch. And sometimes, often, like in the case of Human Rights Watch, they commit not to saying whether wars are just or unjust or legal or illegal, and only to focus on how they're fought and whether they run afoul of these new rules prohibiting inhumanity in the fighting. In the targeting. And so this is like Tolstoy's syndrome starting to come online, because remember, he said the trouble with humane slavery is that we agree with the slaveholders not to contest their right to own slaves and focus on their treatment. And these new humanitarians, in a sense, compromise with the state, never saying whether the wars are just or unjust, legal or illegal, and only focusing on how they're fought. And, you know, that's not a problem, because we should have such groups. But if the rest of us are taking the greater humanity of wars to kind of vouch for their larger morality, then we might allow these new humane wars to kind of go on forever. And that's really my story of what happened after 9/11. I don't think the rise of Holocaust memory or human rights groups is like to blame or was a mistake. On the contrary, this is about a rise in moral consciousness of great evils. But there's a paradox and perversity that, in a way, taking those kinds of evils seriously goes along with a kind of blindness, a forgetting of what our ancestors knew, which is that the biggest evil is war itself.
Mm. So there's an argument that is made by some that the professionalization of the American Army has played a role in this, because yep. So few people actually are engaged in combat. Does that make sense to you?
It does, and it explains a lot, but then I think we should note some limits to the explanation. So I have a passage in the book about the debates around the elimination of the draft and the move to an all-volunteer force, and it's quite fascinating to go back and see how some people worry that it will make war easier. Others insist it'll make it harder for executives to go to war, but, you know, I think it explains, I mean, it's a big explanation for why, you know, the average citizen is not that conscious of wars, because no one he knows or she knows has been forced to go fight them. That had consequences after 2001, but we should still note that the war's unpopularity was at its height under George W. Bush, when a lot of body bags were coming home, and those were volunteers, but nonetheless, their deaths, American deaths, did lead people to get upset. And you probably remember Cindy Sheehan, whose son died, who led a kind of mini anti-war movement. In the end, you know, what I try to show is that the war on terror had a second form. And this new form doesn't rely on troops almost at all or very much, insofar as it's about armed drones and special forces. And in a way, it doesn't matter whether American soldiers are conscripted or volunteer, because the new form of humane war didn't rely on very many soldiers anyway. And so I would say the argument about the draft is really important to have, but we should also recognize that the kind of war we've invented in our time is not one that even restoring the draft might affect, because you don't need soldiers to kill people with drones.
Yeah. You talked about 9/11. Seems that there might have been a reasonable possibility that this emphasis on humanity and warfare would have gone away in the face of this attack and the American response. How is it that America remains at least mostly committed to humanity and warfare?
So this is an edgy part of the book, and I think, you know, it could ruffle feathers, but, you know, the general view is that after 9/11, George W. Bush and his lawyers took the gloves off, and they did something outrageous, which was to lift the constraints of humane war. And of course, that's true. But I think we should recognize that the very fact that they did lift those constraints testifies to how strong they'd already become. After all, there'd been no constraints of that kind for most of American history. And when we go to war in Vietnam, what's amazing is that our politicians announced that they'll follow the Geneva Conventions and make our South Vietnamese ally follow them, not because they matter, but because they don't matter, because you can break them with impunity and no one will care. And so I kind of read what happens immediately after 9/11 as, in a sense, proof of the humanization of war. And then I try to show that most of the debate, and especially around Abu Ghraib and torture, concern the need to reimpose these standards in an atmosphere when there's almost no challenge to the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq, while there's a lot of concern around how the war is fought. And I don't want to trivialize the hard work that went into making George W. Bush's war humane, but we shouldn't neglect in a historical perspective that it was only a couple of years that those standards were dropped. And the big difference from Vietnam and My Lai is that our debate around Abu Ghraib actually debugged the war on terror, and it didn't end. On the contrary, it became endless and more legitimate in the eyes of a lot of observers. So if we don't kind of recognize the limitations of the concern after 9/11 with humanity, both because it was already strong and because it was reimposed relatively quickly, then we miss the real drama of that moment in which humanity ended up helping kind of legitimate a war that goes on even today.
Yeah, and what's maybe most striking about that is the contrast between the loudness is not the right word, but the way in which this debate was carried out in public around and after Abu Ghraib, and what I see at least is the relative silence surrounding the decisions under President Obama to expand drone warfare and expand the American presence across the world using new technology. So can you say a little bit about Obama's decision making and the thinking behind it and how that fits into your argument?
So he runs as the first of presidential candidate, but not the last, since everyone since his won has done it, against aspects of American war. He beats Hillary Clinton in the nominating contest because she has voted for the Iraq war. That's a tradition now, because Donald Trump amazingly, meretriciously came out against the Iraq War in the nominating contest with his Republican rivals, beat them and went on to beat Hillary again. And then Joe Biden runs as an opponent of what he calls forever war. But Obama in office is also the first in the tradition of anti-war candidates who become endless war presidents, because he's a genius, and he decides that he needs to reinvent the war on terror beyond the brutal heavy footprint form that has brought Bush's popularity to all-time lows by the end. And so he says, we'll make it less heavy footprint, more light and no footprint, special forces, drones, and we'll make it humane. And within the first year he does so, he pivots to drones. He goes to Oslo to pick up the Nobel Peace Prize and says openly, although the drone program is still secret, that that while America has to fight terrorism until it's eradicated, it will promise to do so humanely. 4 years later, when he rolls out the drone program, he says, don't worry. The alternative to humane war is brutal war, and you don't want that. And in the absence of peace, you'd much rather have humane war. And so that's a situation in which we hear him and we're reassured. And you know, I didn't mention Tolstoy's analogy with the slaughter of non-human animals, but it's like he says, when you kind of take solace in the fact that your meat is slaughtered for you more humanely and eat it anyway. And even though, you know, the rise of humane slaughterhouses has entrenched meat eating and made it, you know, easier for more animals to die. And, you know, Obama kind of understands that logic, that his audience will kind of accept a deal. If I make the war more humane, you will let me fight it. And that's where we are even today after Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan.
So in the conclusion, you kind of offer your concerns for the future. So I guess the first question about this is to ask you to share with the audience, where might this arc go if it continues?
So, you know, technologically, we've seen not just the rise of drones, but the experimentation with so-called autonomous weapon systems, sometimes, you know, called killer robots or slaughter bots. And, you know, I close the book by imagining what could happen if we continue to fight a kind of global counterterror in search of permanent security while making our means of doing so more and more humane. Because the truth is, even drones do a better job in avoiding civilian harm than other methods. And for that matter, most of the time they're surveilling, not killing anyone. And special forces take unprecedented care when they land in a place. We saw that in the Trump years when he sent most famously when he sent an armed band to take out the leader of the Islamic State. And when they land, their first step is to isolate the innocent. And, you know, Omar al-Baghdadi took two of his family members with him in down a tunnel, and they had to die, but a lot of others survived. Because if you like, this was counterterrorism with care. You know, my worry is that with drones and these new autonomous weapon systems, we're heading into an era in which we realize war can have its violence edited out to an amazing extent. Now, of course, there are always bad apples and honest mistakes in war. And, you know, there's so much violence still in war, but there's less. And we could imagine, to me, what's a chilling future where we have global policing and kind and gentle policing robots to try to achieve this security for us, and us thinking it's okay because it's humane. And that doesn't seem like a good destination from where I sit. I mean, I'm fine, you're fine. But of course, we're at the top of a hierarchy and are not the ones policed in our cities or around the world. And I don't think it's good enough to push for it to be humane policing. And so my plea is to readers to kind of think about that outcome and whether it's one that we should want.
In the last couple of years, maybe 5 years, we've also seen the resurrection of fears of great power conflict. We've seen novels written about it, P.W. Singer's Ghost Fleet. We've seen 2034, I think that's the year identified in this. We've certainly seen a spate of articles. Are we in a new cold? Can you imagine a world in which the balance again shifts and the primary driver to this discussion is actually about eliminating war rather than about making war humane? Or are we so far down the humaneness side of this argument that true pacifists will never kind of tip the scales in their favor again?
You know, it's so hard to predict if a Cold War comes, you know, like the original Cold War, it may not involve head-to-head contests. It may involve a global Cold War. And of course, many of those engagements tended to be the shadow wars. Not all, you know, Korea wasn't, Vietnam wasn't. But we can imagine, as long as America fights shadow wars, that they'll be not just, you know, less visible, but more humane, because that's now part of the conditions for making war legitimate with a certain powerful part of the American public. You know, even Donald Trump, as I narrate, even though he appeals to another part of the American public that and calls for more brutality, he can't get it done, because, you know, humanity is entrenched to an extraordinary extent now in the military, in the way it thinks about the warrior's honor, and in the way that military operations are governed. And yet, of course, a great power war, a conventional war, could well lead the gloves to be taken off. Not briefly, as George W. Bush did, but kind of permanently. Still, you know, these rules aren't just American rules. They've been, you know, written into international law for all powers. And it's not like they're necessarily permanent, but they're not easy to bracket and just wipe away as if they hadn't been. So my sense is that, you know, more confrontation will lead to more calls for peace. I doubt that the rise of more and more policing will, on its own, will lead to more peace, even if I think it should. But, you know, revolutions in kind of morality and thought have happened before. We talked about one, the rise of Holocaust memory. And there's no reason, as far as I can see, why we can't raise consciousness, just as we're doing in the context of American policing, about our policies. You know, we're in a debate in American policing in response to, you know, horrendous violence, about whether there should be more humane policing or less policing. And I just think we could imagine a debate about that at the global level, too. We've chosen the first, more humane policing, but I think just as at home, we can imagine just less policing of our fellow citizens, we could imagine the same for our fellow humans at the global scale.
So to conclude our discussion of the book, I'll just kind of ask an open-ended question. This is at least the home channel for this interview is about mass atrocity violence. So I'll just ask you to say something and take this wherever you want to go with this. How has this development of a culture of emphasizing the humane in conflict, how has that shaped responses to or ideas about genocide and ethnic cleansing and other kinds of mass atrocity violence?
Well, the rise of that concern is central to the story because if ethnic cleansing and genocide, along with, you know, crimes against humanity and war crimes, are central to your moral vision, you will do things like respond to Bosnia, maybe by dithering about intervention, but then setting up an international tribunal. You'll respond to Rwanda by missing your chance, if there was one, but setting up an international tribunal. You'll respond to Kosovo in the way that, you know, Bill Clinton did, and I was involved in that as a lowly intern, kind of preventing genocide by force of arms. And, you know, one of my points in the book is to say these are essential and noble concerns, but in a way they've been taken as pretext for abetting war, where our ancestors really thought that war itself is the crime, not war crimes alone, because once war starts, not only do a lot of soldiers die legally, but civilians do too. Instability and refugee flows follow that may be moral outrages, but are legally allowed. Taxes are diverted to one thing rather than another. And the results are bad for all concerned. And so my hope would be that we, as people who are involved in genocide and Holocaust studies, as I have been, that we connect those fields more fully to peace studies, which, you know, rise and fell after Vietnam and fell as concerns with genocide rose in our curricula and our teaching. You know, the truth is, you know, political scientists teach us that mass atrocity occurs most frequently in the context of war, not on its own. And so these aren't different agendas. They're deeply connected. And, you know, I think we're seeing more and more emphasis on, let's say, transcending a narrower conception of what it means to be concerned with ethnic cleansing and genocide and war crimes, and embedding it within a larger concern about, you know, domination and violence, you know, when war comes in general.
Yeah, that's a, like your book, that's a thought-provoking answer, and I'll have to sit and reflect on that. We've taken a lot of your time, Sam. So I always end with the same two questions. One is, I've got a stack of exams next to me that I don't really feel like grading. I wonder if you can suggest a book or a movie or documentary, something that was important to you in the process of writing this book that the audience and I should watch or listen or hear.
Well, you know, you've suggested a great Star Trek episode, and you know, I know that your listeners will stream that immediately. I'm going to recommend Jonathan Schell's reporting on the Vietnam War, which was pretty central to me when I first started thinking about this topic. He wrote two books, one called The Village of Ben Suk and one called The Military Half, which have now been combined into a book that you can order from your local bookseller or multinational conglomerate called the real war. And it just reminds us of how much access journalists once had to American wars and what our soldiers were willing to do in front of those journalists, because he reports just extraordinary brutality that he witnessed and was invited to witness towards prisoners. And obviously he reports on some of the most violent American counterinsurgency in the last 100 years. And I just think it's worth keeping that in mind as we consider how our priorities have shifted, even though we're still at war. And it's just beautifully written. And he was a poet as much as a reporter. And he died a few years ago, but is still very much worth reading.
Yeah, that's a thread that we don't have time to untangle, but the increasing willingness of militaries in the West to allow journalists to report on what they're doing is a fascinating strand. But I can hear pens dropping across the country as people stop grading so that they can read this. I know that it's hard to make professors stop grading, but maybe you've done that. And the second question is simple, if maybe unfair. What are you working on now?
So I'm actually getting a sabbatical in the spring and going to the University of Oxford to give some lectures on Cold War liberalism, and that'll be a small book. And after that, I'm trying to develop a project on the rise of what I'm calling gerontocracy. You know, we're likely heading into a presidential campaign that will feature not just the oldest president, but the oldest presidential challenger, if it's Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. And I think across our politics, we're seeing how our moral success in extending the human lifespan has begun to have political consequences that were neither planned nor foreseen, that have involved the concentration of power at the older end of the age spectrum to the detriment of those trying to launch their lives. And so I want to shift topics entirely away from, you know, the books we've discussed to do something about our American society and the consequences of aging in our time.
They sound like fascinating projects, and I wish you well, and I hope that you'll come back on the New Books Network, if not maybe on this channel for that one, but and talk about them when they're done. But for now, have a great rest of your semester, and I really appreciate talking to you.
Thank you so much.